We welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope, available everywhere, and more coming soon in the pipeline from Colin. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's up, Mr. Main? How's it going, Kimball?
We're doing all right here today. Beautiful weather, no complaints as far as all of that goes. Now, have you been encountering more comely college co-eds to accompany you on your climbing?
No, but let's count this as an advert. So if you are out there listening, comely college young women, feel free to contact the Sea Dog. It can be really fun. It can work out well. If people have no idea what we're talking about, shame on you.
Yes.
Read the blog. But I was on running my stairs the other day, and there was a group of college kids, kind of late in the semester, were going around trying to ask questions of people, and they were getting rebuffed by, like, everybody. They were getting turned down. And I didn't put this in there. But the one person they were turned down by was a guy who was dressed up as an early colonist. What did you think if you're that guy and, like, someone comes over to interview you, it's time to shine? But he's like, no, some other time. And he just kept moving. So then she came over to me as I was running my stairs, and I'm sure you know me well enough, Kimball, to know that the part I enjoyed about this the most wasn't the existential back and forth. It was that this fine young filly was shortly out of breath because she couldn't handle running the stairs. Made me feel good about my heart. I called my mom after as I was going to Haymarket to get peppers. I'm like, the best thing that's happened to me in like 4 years just happened. She was all winded and I was going strong. And then I was depressed because it truly was like the best thing to happen to me in like 4 years.
Well, we're going to talk poetry this afternoon. That'll get us all in a good mood. But let's start with this. What, from your perspective, makes for good poetry?
The same thing that makes for good prose, in a way. And when I was first like reading really hard in like ways that other people don't read, I wasn't going to class in college. I was just off on my own, reading and absorbing. I read a lot of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And what I would write in the margins in certain instances were the initials PP for prose poetry, or perfect prose, because it didn't happen that much. So if you go through like my early marginalia, you'll see like the occasional PP. It's like a big thing to spot. You're doing a lot of the same things. So I think of writing, any form it takes, as more musical than writerly and more sculptural than writerly. And it's also like a painting. So in a weird sort of paradoxical way, writing is like the fifth thing that great writing really is. I would say the first thing that it is, or it should be, is a life experience. And what is the life experience made up of? It's made up of this combination of sound and sense and how we process those two things. So the form can be different, but you're arranging sound, you're working with a jumble of syllables, and there's just a natural ordering that you either have or you don't have as any kind of writer. It just shifts itself out the right way in your mind, and it comes out that way on the page. So I think there's actually a lot of overlap between prose and poetry. People don't talk about it that way, but there is.
And I feel like, and I guess I should know this working in a school, but I feel like we don't expose students to poetry as much as we did. Certainly not when I was in school, when you sometimes had to memorize poems. But I don't see kids talking about poetry the way we did, you know, back in my day.
And that's a valuable tool too. It's like it's less dry, but it's like your scales for music, and it's useful to memorize lines of verse, I find. And when poetry comes up now, it's almost like for the wrong reasons. When we have like sort of middle school doggerel, like Amanda Gorman, and someone is pushed forward, not for what they're actually writing, but for how we read that persona of the individual, what they're supposed to represent in an agenda-driven age. And then you look at the actual verse, and it doesn't work. And so when I was first like, when I was like this angsty high school student, and I'm like, I'm listening to the Doors and all that stuff, I would try to write poetry. It's like all quite bad, but it was an important sort of passageway for me as I was moving on towards getting to where I could hone the other abilities that I actually had. So it's a great way to think about sound and sense. And you're right. I never really hear poetry come up at all. And I saw on Twitter the other day that someone was saying that every jazz musician is underrated because people don't even know who, like, Louis Armstrong is. I was thinking, people don't really know who anyone is about anything other than just, like, whatever stupid person is going to be out of the news cycle shortly. And it made me think about poets. And depressingly, I don't know how many people know who, like, Shakespeare is. They've heard the name. They probably don't even know his name. But, like, how many people, if you go out in the street, and would be like, oh, yeah, poet dude, who put it in, like, a dramatic kind of way. So I think it's something that needs to be redressed because there is that maw-like hole in our education system with poetry.
We're talking to Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's start with Wallace Stevens and his short poem, Anecdote of the Jar.
Now, you had, it's when we have the word jar in the title of a poem, I think anyone who reads poem flashes back to Keats and Ode on a Grecian Urn. So you're sort of playing, or you're playing around with that. And this is, a couple of these are very short, so I'll just read this. And it's called, like you said, Anecdote of the Jar. I placed a jar in Tennessee, and round it was upon a hill. It made the slovenly wilderness surround that hill. The wilderness rose up to it and sprawled around no longer wild. The jar was round upon the ground and tall and of a port in air. It took dominion everywhere. The jar was gray and bare. It did not give of bird or bush like nothing else in Tennessee. Now, this poem really functions with the key verb and the key noun. And the key noun is going to be that idea of dominion, because this is about how we frame perspective, how we look at something. It's not the same as relativism, but this is the poet saying, okay, most people come to this scene and they would think that it's the other way around, that, like, the jar is almost the incidental thing, the man-made creation. But he is imbuing the narrator of this poem, that jar, with the dominion. And then we have the verb made. It made the slovenly wilderness. So we're getting order. And, of course, nature is rigorously ordered on its own. It might seem mangy to us, but think of how things occur in patterns of three in nature, all of that sort of jazz. But it made the slovenly wilderness. It's making something. It's, again, it's exercising that muscle of dominion. So it's just these short lines. And there are moments where we think a rhyme's going to come, and it doesn't. It's like not even an off rhyme. And then later, when we're waiting for there not to be a rhyme again, he gives the rhyme. He gives, like, the internal rhyme. So it's just sort of like this surprise fest in these very few lines.
Well, and I like the simplicity of it, but there's a depth there that you don't perhaps get on first reading. But when you go back and think about it, yeah, whose perspective are you taking in all of this?
Wallace Stevens was, I've just been spending a lot of time with his work lately. He's one of my favorite American poets, and he would write a drama too, which is like a hybrid. There's a with his poetry, there's a playfulness, and I think a lot of times poets can become arch there, especially now. There's nothing there. It's from academia, and that has this archness to it. This, when you have archness, you have a brittleness. You don't have that kind of give, that sponginess of Wallace Stevens's sort of fecundity. And that's what you get here, because you get the learnedness, but again, it's like someone holding forth at recess, not within the classroom. And so that, to me, is quintessentially American when we're talking poetry. And that's something that really all of the great American poets have had in common. I mean, we'll see that here. As different as they are from each other, as different as their backgrounds are, everything like that, they do have that kind of protean fecundity in common between all of them.
I love the story, too. I was researching Stevens a little bit, and I was not familiar with this story, that apparently somewhere along the way he broke his hand socking Hemingway in the jaw.
Hemingway is, I really dislike Hemingway's writing. It's probably like all over the blog, and I'm sure mentioned this many a place. That notion of of the machismo, the forced machismo. It drives me out of my mind. I'm sure I've mentioned to you at some point that Wells said, Orson Welles said, the greatest artists are more feminine than masculine. And that wasn't a gender thing. It was more like a candor thing, a vulnerability thing. I'm certainly that way. And so Hemingway was always like, I need to lead this way. And Wallace Stevens didn't really, I wouldn't call him feminine, but I wouldn't call him masculine either. He was more of this learned jocularity merchant. And so the playfulness might not come through at first with Wallace Stevens if you're not used to reading poetry. But when you do read it, you see that. So he was this sort of mild-mannered guy for the most part. This wasn't like his full-time gig. This Anecdote of the Jar was in his first collection, his first and best collection that came out in 1919, Harmonium. But there are a lot of poems in it. It's like 85 poems. And that's the great thing, too, I think, about poetry of this nature. You don't have to go through the whole book. You can jump in and you can treat yourself to, these are three stanzas of four lines each. And when you experience them, you've experienced a work of art. I mean, it's like Twitter-type size. And there it is, life experience. When you could have like 100 like that a day. And so, yeah, there it is, Anecdote of the Jar.
From Wallace Stevens to Walt Whitman, from Leaves of Grass, and a poem that originally was untitled, now known as I Sing the Body Electric, a celebration of body but also soul.
Leaves of Grass changed a lot, and when it was first published, it was far fewer poems than ended up being. But then, like you said, none of them had titles, actually. It's like, ah. And it was marketed by his publisher as, this isn't so hot, but it's weird. It's esoteric. Wouldn't you like something strange in your house? So I'm not sure how much they were helping him out with that. What I would say about this poem is, and it's typical of some of the other themes we see in Leaves of Grass, it's the most somatic poem I've ever encountered, certainly in the United States. There's a kind of somatic quality to some of John Clare's verse when he's out a rambling in the English wilds. But like you said, this is that commingling of body and soul. It's like if you've ever read the essays of Montaigne, he's very earthy, and he'll be like, oh, I have a carbuncle on my ass. And then he'll talk about it like he's into it. Like he just does not draw any distinction between that and some kind of like sunset he saw. Whitman is an American, he was French, Montaigne, is a kind of like American Montaigne in that sense. And there is a quality of friendship. I mean, a lot of people could find a lot to do, don't you think, with this particular poem, whether it's like men, whether it's women. It's a celebration of the female in many ways. But this third part of the poem, it's like a little short story. It's always resonated with me since the first time I read this, when he writes, I knew a man, a common farmer, the father of five sons, and in them the fathers of sons, and in them the fathers of sons. This man was of wonderful vigor, calmness, beauty of person. The shape of his head, the pale yellow and white of his hair and beard, the immeasurable meaning of his black eyes, the richness and breadth of his manners. There I used to go and visit him to see. He was wise also. He was 6 feet tall. He was over 80 years old. His sons were massive, clean, bearded, tan-faced, handsome. They and his daughters loved him. All who saw him loved him. They did not love him by allowance. They loved him with personal love. He drank water only. The blood showed like scarlet through the clear brown skin of his face. He was a frequent gunner and fisher. He sailed his boat himself. He had a fine one presented to him by a ship joiner. He had fowling pieces presented to him by men that loved him. When he went with his five sons and many grandsons to hunt or fish, you could pick him out as the most beautiful and vigorous of the gang. You would wish long and long to be with him. You would wish to sit by him in the boat, that you and he might touch each other. I mean, that's it. That's the point. I mean, that is life. That is encapsulated in that section because, again, the notion of the somatic, that we yearn so much to partake of someone else's humanness, to get closer to them in the boat so that their leg might graze us. there is something literal there and something metaphoric at the same way. And I think that's what you're sort of referring to when you talk about the mind in that split, the mind-body or the body and the soul. But that functions as almost like, what do you even call that? Yeah, sure, that's poetry. But again, see the protean control, but it's also like mangy because he's versifying in ways that you're not supposed to versify. And this just would have rocked people, like Elvis rocked people in the 50s, like, whoa, you can do that? Because this is not how anyone wrote poetry. It was wild and free, but it was also pure emotional control and finesse.
And we've talked about this with you before. You do it so well. The best writers do it. That ability to let us know an entire life of a character in an economy of words.
We know his life. And it's, again, we come back to that term, the stacking of details. But you know what? I was thinking about this. It's like when you watch a film and the camera's on somebody, like they exist. They're fully existing and the camera happens to be on them. They're not built up from like, okay, here's a person kit and stick this bone into this joint. They already exist. And the way other people write is they start with the kit and they're like, ah, screw this together and solder this, and where's my glue and my scotch tape? We don't want any of that. We just want the life. We want to start with the life, and we get this man's life through all of these details. We even get the life of his sons, his daughters, his grandchildren. They're in there, too. We have a sense of him. He drank water only. The blood showed like scarlet through the clear brown skin of his face. Mm. We know what he looks like. We know what he smells like. We have an idea of his pungency from the fish and the hunting, and he's this octogenarian. And yet, again, is he old? Is he young? He stands outside of that whole space-time continuum. He's not an archetype. He's humanist. He is himself. And so it's just like sort of the perfect Whitman figure for this book. This book was modernism. This is 1855. So this is like, we think of modernism as like the early 1920s and Joyce and Ulysses. This is modernism before modernism was close to existing. It just is a vanquisher, a despoiler of label. And I find that so exciting. That's what has always moved me in any kind of art, any kind of life, and they're synonymous to me.
Now, I had not read The Maldive Shark before by Melville, and now I have a much greater appreciation for those hardworking, heroic pilot fish rather than those lazy sharks.
Remember that episode of Cheers, Cleveland? he's doing his facts.
Yes.
He has one about the pilot fish. And the whole like joke in Cheers is when Clavin says that he picks out the little bits of meat. Like he breaks it down that way, like the way Clavin would. So I've always sort of thought of Cliff when reading this, the Maldive Shark, which is from the end of, he only has like 3 years to go. I mean, not even when Melville writes this poem. And I think it's just one of those things that people don't associate Melville with poetry. They just think Moby Dick, but he thought of himself as a poet. And especially when he gave up prose, he's like, screw this. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm just going to be this, as friends thought he was like wild, and Hawthorne didn't really understand him. And again, it's that idea of the freedom, an artistic freedom, a vision and a purpose and doing your thing. And so this is a highly, wouldn't you say, biblically resonant poem. Melville
could
get awfully Bible-y, I would say. But it's this story in a way about the partnership between the little pilot fish and like Jaws. I mean, actual Jaws.
Right.
And then like a shark that we can think of in a Jaws kind of way about the shark, like magical one. It's just such a Melville word, like magical. Pale sots of the male dive sea, the sleek little pilot fish, azure and slim. How alert in attendance be? It's kind of sing song. From his saw pit of mouth, from his charnel of maw, they have nothing of harm to dread, but liquidly glide on his ghastly flank, or before his gorgonian head, or lurk in the port of serrated teeth, in white triple tiers of glittering gates, and there find a haven when perils abroad, an asylum and jaws of the fate. They are friends, and friendly they guide them to prey, yet never partake of the treat, eyes and brains to the dotted lethargic and dull, pale ravener of horrible meat. We have to keep in mind, this is a man who is coming to the end of his own earthly journey, too. So it gives it, like, a little more resonance when you think of it that way, because it is a story of an odd friendship. And that's something that is interesting me more and more in my work as I go along, the nature of, like, odd, unlikely relationships. Because really, those are the relationships that make up the whole of our relational lives. They're not like, well, my best friend and I were the same age. No, it's sort of like, are these passing ship in the night relationships that are going to determine, like, the quality of the overall relationships you've had in your life. So Melville takes this back to the natural level with this. And yet it's a very, again, it's a very human poem, even though it's about fish.
And finally, Ralph Waldo Emerson's Concord Hymn. Now, was this a contract job? Was he commissioned to write this when they celebrated the Battle Monument in 1837?
Yeah, he was. That's pretty much how it went down. Now, have you ever been to the Old Man?
I have, yeah, many years ago, but used to go there a lot as a kid.
So the great thing about the Old Man is that it's virtually unchanged. And it's like, if you had shown up on that April morning for the shot heard around the world, you would have seen, like, what I see when I go out to Concord now, what you saw on the school field trips and stuff when you were a kid. It is a place of peace that's also fairly haunting, but not in an eldritch way, unlike any I have ever visited. I mean, wouldn't you say? It just has that feel to it. When you go out to the bridge, which is now pretty close to what the bridge was on that day, that famous day that essentially started the Revolutionary War. I mean, what we think of is like the official start of the war. You could imagine, like, all of a sudden people marching down and about to have at each other. And this is the battle where the colonists, for the first time, advanced upon the British. And now imagine, like, if you were on the British side, and all of a sudden you see these people, like, marching upon you. Have you ever, like, picked, like, a snapping turtle up? If you, like, snapping turtle, like, it won't just go off in its merry way. It turns around, and it's like, okay, let's do this, let's throw. And it advances upon you. It's like, what are you doing, dude? I just took you out of the road. And it's like, no, I want to end you. That's how I want to handle this morning. So Ralph Waldo Emerson, who lives in the Old Man's, the house. I mean, what a house. It was his grandfather's, so he's just kind of like staying there now. And later he's going to be like, hey, Hawthorne, you want to rent my house? And Hawthorne's like, yeah, okay, I will rent it, and I'll propose to my woman here, and we'll love and we'll etch our, like, feelings about each other into the windows, and you can still see that. So, yeah, it's a contract job. In homage to this battle, this key battle, and not only was it, like, read out, it was sung out, like, with a tune, so it had to be pretty mellifluous, and it is. It's like one of those ones when you mention kids don't read this, blah, blah, blah. This is one of the ones that you just would have memorized back in the day. I mean, it's like the Pledge of Allegiance, but better.
And it is one of the few things that has remained with us in talking about history and poetry, because to this day, if I mention to young students the shot heard round the world, those with any kind of a clue at least have some recognition that it's about the beginning of the Revolutionary War.
It's one of those phrases that, like, don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Mm. And I was actually over at the Bunker Hill Monument today after I ran my stairs, and I took a walk, and I wanted to see if that obelisk was open again. Feels like they're never going to open it. But I came upon this foundation spot that was excavated by archaeologists of this tavern that dated to 1630. And it went on until 1775, until the day that the Battle of Bunker Hill at Breed's Hill was fought. And the British torched it to the ground. And so I was just thinking, like, wow, we are so proximate to not just, I don't want to say like history, because history is something that can sometimes become entombed. We're proximate to a spiritual center, a kind of core of ideals of the self and the greater good of the populace that I think we often range far from in these times for various reasons. And so that's another thing that's happening in this poem, is that Emerson is bestowing that spiritual unity, that home base quality of the nation, of the republic. Let's not even call it the nation, of the republic. It's like Fitzgerald with the green fields of the republic rolled on under the night. He's using republic in like the Platonian sense, and that's something that goes beyond just this country in a way. It's an idea of a sort of conscience purity. And so that's what Emerson is using, this place that remains magnificently unchanged and peaceful. And I'll tell you this too, that the bridge, all these different versions of the bridge, I was so excited when I went to the museum. There's a museum not too far from the old man, so if you just keep walking up the hill. They had the original planking that was discovered under the mud.
Oh, wow.
From the bridge. And it was just like hanging on the wall. And it was like modeled the way, like if you ever see like cedar and it's like floated down, like on the Ponderosa, it's gone down like the river and the stream and everything, it changes color. It was like looking at a painting. And I just like, imagine if that wood could talk. It's like, oh, I'm out of the mud. I got some stories. It just, I was transfixed by it. And I thought of this poem as I stood in front of this wood for like 15 minutes. It was just like the coolest sort of discovery. And someone else might have seen it and been like, oh, it's a hunk of wood. Why is it on the wall? But I don't know. It brought a lot of things home for me.
And it is one of those places, you're right, that I think more than a number of historical sites, it's very easy to get transported back to that moment in time when you're there.
Oh, it's unchanged. I mean, really, like what has changed? Like the sort of the lie of the trees, like things like that. But it's just like you're on site for something that's about to happen. When you walk out there too, like you go past, it's just one of those things that's enriched by how much you know. Like, for instance, you go past a former tavern. It's like the original structure, but it's now like, I think it's like an inn. And it's where the wounded were carried. So like lots of British and American, because that's one of the things about war. Once you're wounded, like you're kind of carted off. And then imagine the conversations that would have happened like between like a redcoat and a farmer, a conquered farmer. And so it's a supposedly haunted spot, you know, that whole thing kinds of works. But you get out to the old manse and I mean, really, I've been out there early in the morning with like a book. Just reading as the mist is on the Concord River, subject of Thoreau's first book. And it's just, it's to be enveloped in something ghostly, but peaceful. And yeah, it's just, I've never felt an energy like that spot has.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Colin, we thank you. As always, next week, I believe we're going to talk about some more stories from the new book.
Yes, we are. The next four. And then the week after, we'll do a bunch of F. Scott Fitzgerald stuff if you're up for the challenge.
Absolutely. And I look forward to talking about Cheerwine next week.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever had that?
I have had Cheerwine, yes.
You see, you have like an 80% batting average. When I say, you ever been there? You ever heard that? You usually... you have it somewhere in your stockpile, your repository of experiences. So you're a good man that way, Mr. Kimball.
I'm just old, Colin, that's all.
Ah, come on! You're not a Maldive shark! Kimball, I will be your pilot fish.
No, but I would be two steps behind that young co-ed who was struggling to keep up with you.
The thing that I don't know if I said this, but the thing I said to her was like, oh, come on, when she's all winded. I'm like, oh, come on, an athletic person like you.
The always endearing Colin Fleming every Tuesday on Downtown. Thank you, Colin. We'll see you next week.
All right, take care.